The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. This is Brad McDonald, and I'll be taking the program today for Stephen Flurry. Well, I thought we could begin by talking a little about Greece. Perhaps you've seen images of the long queues outside ATMs in Greece, images of some of the protests that have been happening this week, images of fuel being rationed at petrol stations throughout Greece. We'll talk more about some of these grim details in a moment. But first, let's consider who Greece is. Greece is a first world country. Greece is a democratic nation, one of the oldest democracies in the world. Greece has an advanced financial and banking system. Its economy is well developed. It has access to raw materials. Its manufacturers use sophisticated technology. It has a healthy export industry, exporting goods all over the world. Greece has schools and universities, a good education system. Greece has an advanced welfare system. It has hospitals and top-notch doctors, access to the best medicines. Greece is a thriving culture and society. Again, it's a first world country. Greece is not a third world nation. It doesn't have underdeveloped financial systems. It doesn't lack for resources or lack for technology. It has democratic leadership. Its general public is not uneducated. Greece is a first world Western country. Greece is, or at least it was, just like Britain or America. But let's take a look at what's happening right now to this advanced country. And as we consider some of these facts, think about this. Why couldn't this happen to America? Why couldn't this happen to Britain or to any other Western country? Now, you're probably aware of what's happening in Greece. The country owes billions of dollars to two or three European institutions, particularly the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund. This past Tuesday, Greece defaulted on paying 1.6 billion euros to the IMF. And this was really a milestone in the Greek crisis and a milestone in, let's say, the global economy, a first world nation defaulting on its payment to the International Monetary Fund. And that has set in motion all kinds of really pretty disturbing and worrying events in Greece this week. I'll just read a quote from a Telegraph article from today, July 3rd. The article says, Greece is sliding into a full-blown national crisis as the final cash reserves of the banking system evaporate by the hour and swaths of industry start to shut down, precipitating the near disintegration of the ruling government coalition. This is a historic moment for Greece, and it really could be a historic moment for Europe and even the world. Over the past few days, capital controls have been imposed in Greece. That means that there are now restrictions on how much money Greek citizens can withdraw from the bank. 25 to 30 billion euros have been withdrawn from Greek banks in the last 3 weeks. That's incredible. And really, it shows that the Greek people, justifiably, have lost confidence in their financial system. They've lost confidence in their government. So they're lining up at banks, taking money out, and I don't know, putting it under their mattress, storing it in the ground. I don't know where they put it. But confidence in the Greek financial system is rapidly deteriorating. Greeks in recent weeks have been withdrawing 3,000 euros a second from cash machines across the country. Now, under the current capital controls, a Greek person can only withdraw 50 euros from an ATM. Think about that. What if that was you? What if the government told you that you could only take out 50 euros a day from an ATM? As it stands now, the cash reserves of Greek banks is at 500 million euros. That's all that is left in Greek banks, 500 million euros. And if there's not an injection soon, even today, the banks, Greek banks, will be out of money. Imagine that, banks without money. There are reports of manufacturing companies in Greece having trouble paying vendors because they don't have access to money. And now some of these companies are talking about closing down, which means layoffs, which means not providing services, which means not providing goods. Again, this is all happening right now, and not in Africa, not in South America, not in Russia. This is happening right now in Greece, in the Western world. I'll just read a quote from a fellow by the name of Konstantin Michalos, head of the Hellenic Chambers of Commerce. And he said that lenders are simply running out of money. And here's what he said. We are reliably informed that the cash reserves of the banks are down to 500 million euros. Anybody who thinks they are going to open again on Tuesday is daydreaming. The cash would not last an hour. We are in an extremely dangerous situation. Greek companies have been excluded from the electronic transfers of Europe's Target 2 system. The entire Greek business community is unable to import anything. And without raw materials, they can't produce anything. This is where we are in Greece. And as you can imagine, there's a massive domino effect that comes from banks not having any money to give to people, to lend to people. Pavlos Dias owns an olive processing factory in Greece. And here's what he told the Telegraph. He told the Telegraph that his plant may have to shut down, which would mean that 250 people that he employs would be without a job. This is what he said. We can't send any money abroad to our suppliers. Three of our containers have been stopped at customs control because the banks can't give a bill of lading. One is full of Spanish almonds, the other full of Chinese garlic. We don't know how we are going to execute and export an order of 60 containers for the US. We don't even have enough gas. We asked for 10,000 liters, but they are only letting us have 2,000. It's being rationed by the day. Factories are closing around us in a domino effect, and we're all going to lose everything if this goes on. There are reports of people hoarding petrol, long lines at petrol stations as worried Greeks line up to fill their tanks, not knowing if there's going to be petrol a few days down the road, not knowing if they're going to have access to their bank account or their credit card to pay for petrol a few days down the road. One in four Greeks right now are unemployed. And that's only going to go up as some of these companies begin to lay off employees. Youth unemployment in Greece is around 50%. I think it's just over 50%. By some measures, this is worse than the Great Depression of the late 1920s. It is by far the worst economic disaster to strike a Western nation since World War II. Notice what Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek finance minister, said. He said that we are on a war footing in this country. The situation in Greece is dire. It's extreme. Again, why couldn't this happen to America or Britain? What's to stop? What's to say it can't happen again? Greece was a first world country. Greece has an advanced economy. Greece has advanced and sophisticated banking and financial systems. Greece was a sophisticated, advanced, healthy, thriving, first-rate Western power. And now look at what's happening to this country. Why couldn't this happen in America or Britain? America is something like $17 trillion in debt. Now, let's consider where all this could end for Greece. Let's think about what could happen in the coming weeks and months in Greece and in Europe, and where this could end for any other nation that might find itself in a similar situation. I'm just going to read a few quotes from George Friedman. Mr. Friedman is the CEO of Stratfor. And earlier this year, he published a book called Flashpoints. And in Flashpoints, Friedman explores the conditions in Europe, and he shows how fragile and how dangerous some of the trends are in Europe right now. And in the book, he talks about this issue of massive unemployment, and he talks about what kind of an impact that this can have on national politics. And in the book, he has the reader think about a middle-class family and a man who is a professional. Maybe he's a doctor or an accountant, or he's a mid-level manager. And this man has a wife and two or three children. He owns a home. He has one or two vehicles, and he can afford to go out for dinner regularly. He can take annual vacations with his family. And Friedman just, he makes the point, or he asks the question, what happens when the breadwinner is suddenly unemployed? What happens when this man's lifestyle is put in jeopardy? What happens when he can't pay his mortgage or his car loan, or he loses his savings, or he loses access to his savings? What happens when they can't afford to go out for dinner any longer, or they can't take annual vacations? All of these things are happening in Greece right now. But the point that Friedman is making here is what happens when these kind of things happen to the middle class, not to the poorer people, but to the middle class. What happens when the doctor or the accountant, or like I said, the mid-level manager, what happens when his lifestyle is ripped out from underneath him? What happens when there's no longer any hope that his children could go to university? What happens when his wife has to go out and work? What happens when he loses his house because he's lost his job and he can't make his mortgage payment? I'll just read directly now from George Friedman. The poor are poor, and it is usually difficult to make them poorer. But if that happens, it's not a radical change, and often it's what they expect from life. But a professional in his 40s is facing a crisis that he never did expect, did not cause, and that has changed his sense of self profoundly. He has lost not only his wealth earned by labor, but his sense of self. Who is he if he's not a lawyer or a doctor or a shopkeeper? When the middle classes fall into the ranks of the unemployed poor, and when that fall is inexplicable and worse, something from which there would appear to be no chance to recover, that is where political instability begins. Friedman is making an important point here. What happens when the middle class? What happens when people who are accustomed to a certain standard of living, a certain lifestyle, loses everything? Loses their job, loses their car, loses the freedom to go to a restaurant or to take a vacation or to buy his family clothes. What happens when that person loses his sense of self, as Friedman put it? That person becomes unstable, and they become vulnerable to emotion, vulnerable to more extreme ideas and views, and they'll do almost anything to get that lifestyle back, to restore their sense of identity. In his book, Friedman explains how in the 1930s, a lot of Europeans began blaming the Jews for the troubles that they experienced. A lot of Europeans found themselves in this position where they began to suffer financially, where their lifestyle was upended. And they began to look around, looking to blame someone. This is what Friedman says. In a world that has become incomprehensible, that which can be understood is seized on, even if it is preposterous. And Friedman explains how what is happening in Greece and in Portugal and Spain and elsewhere is a recipe for disaster. He writes, unemployed youths are dangerous. They become thieves or gravitate to extremist organizations, but by themselves, they lack the weight to pose a political threat. But combine them with the shattered older middle class, and you have both the gravitas and energy needed to threaten the status quo. And that is what's beginning to happen in Greece and in other European countries. Millions of unemployed youth, and now increasingly millions of disconcerted, worried, anxious middle-class citizens are combining to become this powerful and influential force. We see proof of this in the rise of some of the more marginal political parties in Europe. Consider that Greece today is ruled by a political party that before 2009 was winning under 5% of the vote. They're being ruled by a party that has only been a real force in Greek politics for about 5 years. And it's not just the rise of Syriza, the governing left-wing party. In Greece, we also have Golden Dawn, which is an openly Nazi party. And in the latest elections, Golden Dawn won 6% of the vote. Some polls now put support for Golden Dawn as high as 10%. This same trend is happening all across southern Europe. In Spain, it's PASOK. In Italy, it's the Five Star Movement. In France, it's the National Front. There is political instability in Europe that we haven't seen since the 1930s. Many of the more marginal political parties that espouse some fairly extreme views, are becoming more popular, not just with the unemployed youth, but also with the middle-class citizens. Now, all this is happening at exactly the same time another dramatic trend is unfolding in Europe. And we haven't really seen this trend either since the 1930s. And I'm talking about the rise of Germany. In many ways, the crisis in Greece has helped thrust Germany to center stage in Europe. At every stage of the Greek crisis, Germany has been the key voice, the deciding voice in what happens in Greece. Whenever both sides have tried to reach a deal, it was always done with the German parliament in mind. Will the German parliament pass this deal? When the Greek prime minister recently released his compromise proposal, it was Germany that everyone looked to for a response. And when German Chancellor Angela Merkel said no, that was it. It was finished. This crisis has empowered Germany. Here are some quotes from European newspapers and from some pretty respected and prominent journalists here in England and Europe. And they show just how clear it is that Germany is now the power in Europe. This first quote was from The Telegraph, from Stephen Green in The Telegraph on June 23rd, 2015. Germany finds itself at the geographic an economic center, and therefore increasingly the political center too of the new Europe. No longer do all roads lead to Paris, but to Berlin. Simon Heffer wrote in the Daily Mail on the 29th of March, 2013, history shows it is always only a matter of time before Germany ends up dominating Europe. After years of refusing to assert itself, Germany's time has come again. The Fourth Reich is here without a shot being fired, and the rest of Europe and the world had better get used to it. This next quote comes from Nigel Farage. He said this in front of the European Parliament on November 16th, 2011. We are now living in a German-dominated Europe, something that the European project was actually supposed to stop, something that those that went before us actually paid a heavy price in blood to prevent. Peter Oborne, writing in the Daily Telegraph, July 21st, 2011, Germany has come very close to realizing Bismarck's dream of an economic empire stretching from Central Europe to the Eastern Mediterranean. This next one is from Peter Zeihan and Marco Papik, Stratfor analysts, July 26, 2011. Germany is on the verge of once again becoming a great power. Germany's reemergence does force a radical rethinking of the European and Eurasian architectures. This final one comes from Martin Wolf, a highly respected journalist here in Europe, and he's writing for the Financial Times on May 8th, 2012. This is not a monetary union. It is far more like an empire. Listen to the language these men are using. Germany has a Fourth Reich. There's a number of articles explaining how German politicians and EU bureaucrats have been interfering with and even toppling elected governments all over Europe, but especially in Italy, Spain, and Greece. Ambrose Evans Pritchard explained in the Telegraph last month how German and EU bureaucrats had, and this is quoting Pritchard, had, quote, sent secret letters to the elected leaders of Spain and Italy in August 2011 demanding detailed changes to its internal laws. These officials sent letters to the leaders of Spain and Italy and said, you need to change this law, and this law. And if you don't, you're not going to receive bailout money. You're not going to receive support from Germany and support from the European Union. German and EU officials are largely responsible for removing Italy's Silvio Berlusconi from office in 2011. German and EU officials were responsible for removing the Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou, in 2011. Both Berlusconi and Papandreou opposed the plans of German and EU officials, and they were removed from power. This week, The Times here in the UK reported, quote, one of Europe's most influential politicians, and they made it clear that this was a German politician, one of Europe's most influential politicians, a German, had told them that they were trying to bring about a regime change in Greece. Greece is no longer a sovereign nation. They have European creditors, which essentially means Germany, holding a gun to their head. This is a major change in Europe. This is a major change in international affairs. And it's been happening slowly. It's happened in fits and spurts over the last 7 years. Because of this, people haven't really paid much attention to what is happening. But consider what this means for the world. Consider what it means that Germany is becoming increasingly powerful politically. Here's what George Friedman wrote. The question of Europe now is again the question of Germany, or what Germany wants, what it fears, what it will and won't do. This is the old question of Europe. It goes along with the oldest question in Europe. When will the next war start and where will it be fought? In 1945, very few would have imagined the Germany of the 21st century, and those who did would have been terrified. I'll read that again. In 1945, very few would have imagined the Germany of the 21st century, and those who did would have been terrified. Very few would have ever thought at the end of World War II that Germany would be dominating Europe today the way it does. One man did, though. Mr. Armstrong was prophesying right at the very end of the Second World War. Mr. Armstrong was prophesying that Germany would once again dominate Europe. Remarkable. Okay, well, I thought we could end by just considering a scripture. There are a lot of scriptures, a lot of prophecies talking about or explaining what's happening in the world right now, what's happening in Europe right now. But here in Isaiah 10, verse 5, it talks specifically, God talks specifically about the German nation. In verse 5 of Isaiah 10, God says, "O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation." Now, Assyria here, as we've proved so many times, is modern-day Germany. This is a prophecy about modern-day Germany. And to prove the identity of the Assyrian people today, go ahead and request the United States in Britain in prophecy. You can do that at thetrumpet.com. But Mr. Armstrong in that book explains the identity of ancient Assyria. But Germany right now is rapidly evolving into this dominant political and military power that Isaiah 10 verse 5 implies. And what we see happening in Greece, all of the events happening in Greece are a huge catalyst for this transformation of Germany. Notice verse 6 of Isaiah 10. "I will send him, Assyria, against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets." See, this German-led European empire is a tool in God's hands, and God uses this rod to correct a hypocritical nation. Who is that nation? Well, that nation, again, as we explain every day almost at thetrumpet.com, and as we show every day almost at thetrumpet.com, this hypocritical nation is Israel, which today is comprised mainly of America and Britain. Think about this. God is saying that in the end time, he will use Germany to correct Britain and America. But Britain and America are pretty strong powers. How do they become vulnerable to Germany and this European power? How do they become susceptible to attack from Germany and this European power? Well, their collapse, their transformation into a weak, divided, pathetic power occurs much the same way Greece has transformed into a really weak, unstable, chaotic nation. Like Greece, Britain and America are riddled with debt. Their economies are weak. Unemployment is going to go up. There's going to be a massive financial meltdown, just like we've seen in Greece. In America in particular, conditions are brewing for the perfect storm, a massive financial meltdown. There's massive racial tension. Police forces and local enforcement is declining. America could very easily and very quickly become Greece. This is why, wherever we live in the world, we really need to be paying attention to what's happening in Greece and paying attention to what's happening in Europe. Events in Greece are going to give rise to a dominant political and military European superpower. And that superpower is going to be led by Germany. And God's going to use that power to correct the nations of America and Britain. And think, too, that America and Britain are not entirely different than Greece. Greece is an example of what can happen when you rack up debt, when you accrue debt that you cannot repay. And if it can happen to Greece, an advanced first world country, then it can happen to America, and it can happen to Britain. Pay attention to events in Greece, because what's happening in that country will soon be happening in your city, in your town, in your neighborhood. These are serious times. These are sobering times. And we really need to be paying attention to what's happening in the world around us. Well, thanks for listening. I'll probably be back on Monday. And until then, goodbye.
The Trumpet Daily. The very best minds in the world are in total ignorance of the unprecedented cataclysm that is about to strike. And why have these prophecies not been understood or believed? Because the vital key that unlocks prophecy to our understanding had been lost. That key is the identity of the United States and the British peoples in biblical prophecy. That key has been found. It is presented to those whose unprejudiced eyes are willing to see in this volume, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. The events prophesied to strike the American and British peoples in the next few years are sure. These colossal world events, shrinking the first two world wars into insignificance, will come, but not until the warning has been made available for those whose eyes are willing to see. Request The United States and Britain in Prophecy today. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Britain has a glorious history. Traces of its legacy are imprinted on nations around the world. Yet the state of Britain today is far from glorious. Drunken young people stumbling down London's sidewalks. Overwhelming immigration problems. A kingdom actually voting on whether to dismember itself. Continual bickering between political parties. Broken families. A failing educational system, and lack of leadership. It's an objective fact that Britain needs hope. But from where? Where is that hope? Is it in a new political party? Is it in a new public bill? Is it in an ideology? Where is the hope? You can find a glimpse of that hope right here at Edstone, our new regional office in the UK. And welcome, by the way, to our brand new television studio in Britain. Edstone is a place where people can learn and live a way of life that works. It's a place where people can put that way of life to the test by living it. And it's a place where people can work together to share it with anyone who is willing to prove it for themselves. As unlikely as it may seem, the hope for Britain starts here on this little campus, filled with people who are proving God's truth day in and day out, who are sharing the Bible's prophecies, and who are broadcasting a way of life that everyone can benefit from.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
In looking at world events today, you're certainly reminded every single day that this is certainly not God's world. This world that we now live in, all that it consists of, is not and never will be God's world. It's Satan's world. That's why Jesus told his disciples, I've chosen you out of the world. God inspired the Apostle Paul over in 2 Corinthians 6 to tell God's people to come out of this world and to be separate from the world and the ways of this world. Paul also wrote in Galatians about this present evil world. When Jesus talked to his disciples about this present world over in Matthew 24, he spoke of its soon coming end. That's the way the Bible talks about the world today. It is coming to an end. I want to start over in Revelation 12 and verse 9 to begin with. Please get your Bible and read along with me and see what God says about this world and the new and better world that's coming. This is Revelation 12, verse 9. It says, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So Jesus didn't come 2,000 years ago to make the best of a bad situation or to try to reform this present evil world into something that's good or that something that God can use. He came to start something new and different. And it started in the smallest possible way with him just selecting 12 disciples, students, that he could teach and educate and that he could prepare to raise up and to establish the church. And then to use that church, it's called the little flock in the Gospels, to use that church then to gather in all those who've never had an opportunity to know God and his truth. And of course, the great fruitful harvest there is going to happen after Jesus Christ's return, not before. After, when Jesus came, as I said, he came to start something entirely different and new, a new civilization. I want to take you to a quote by Herbert W. Armstrong. The title of the article there, as you can see, is College of the Future. Here today, he wrote this back in 1967. He said, yes, this world is going to end. Humanity won't be totally destroyed. God's intervention will prevent it. The earth won't blow up or evaporate or cease to exist, but the world, that is, this system of society, this world's economic, social, religious, educational, and political structures, he says, are definitely going to be destroyed. They will be destroyed by the second coming of Christ. But then he goes on and says, but a totally new world will shine forth. Jesus Christ, with all the divine power and glory of the eternal God, will return to earth to set up the world-ruling kingdom of God. The world tomorrow will be God's world. We are now at the end of man's world. He says, but here, even now, is the herald of the peaceful world tomorrow. So he said, even in this present world, there is a small foretaste. That's what he's getting at. And he concludes this particular quote by saying, already in existence are two of the New World educational institutions, Ambassador College at Pasadena and Ambassador College in England, are recapturing the true values. Mr. Armstrong was a man of education. We've talked about him a lot before on this program. And he once said that the very future of civilization is dependent on its educational system. And when you see where we are in the world today, you can see just how much its system of education has failed man in every respect. And yet in those institutions that Mr. Armstrong raised up, he had a college in Pasadena, California. He had one right here in the UK, down closer to London. Bricket Wood was the name of that campus. He started one later in East Texas as well. Three colleges on this earth. Now, for the story about what happened to those institutions, after Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, you need Raising the Ruins to get the history there, to see what happened, tragically, after he died and after his successors came in and just started to downsize everything and to shut down its operations, the operations of the church, and to do away with Mr. Armstrong's teachings, teachings that were received by millions of people around this earth with open arms. There was a lot of destruction that happened in that church, spiritually speaking, from 1986 right through to today. The church doesn't even exist anymore. But we picked up where Mr. Armstrong left off, and like he did way back in the 1930s, we had to start very, very small as well, back in 1989 with virtually nothing, just a handful of people, but yet a message of hope, and a message that's inspired people, that's brought in families, young people, a work that's grown, and now is spreading over the earth. We're in the midst of our 14th year at Armstrong College. We named the school after Herbert Armstrong. 14 years now into the history, and just recently, a few weeks ago, 9 of our students, one of our graduates, came over here on assignment to support the work going on here at Edstone. Mr. Armstrong often said that the growth of the college paralleled the growth in the work, that as the college grew and expanded, as its facilities and operations multiplied, so too did the work of preaching the gospel as it went right around the world. Let me just take you to one more quote where he makes that point in his autobiography. He said, "It was the development of the college in Pasadena that made possible the growth of the whole gospel work." That's what made possible the growth of that work. And so as our own college, going on now for 14 years, has grown, we've seen the growth in God's end time work as well. Today we have dozens and dozens of students and graduates that are serving in the work of God, performing critical tasks for God's church. All total, we have 72 full-time students. Now that may seem small compared to other institutions, universities, colleges in this world today. But those students have made a serious and significant contribution. And as I said, 9 of them are over here now supporting God's work. And if you look at the wonderful atmosphere here on this campus, just like the one back in Edmond, Oklahoma, the headquarters campus, you see many of the same things, a very uplifting and wholesome environment to live in, to work in. It's happy, it's peaceful, it's very busy, and very fast-paced. Let's look at over at Hebrews chapter 10, Paul's epistle to the brethren there in Judea, Hebrews 10 and verse 19 to begin with. Let me just read you another quote as you turn over there. This is from Mr. Armstrong back in 1949. He said, "Ambassador College isn't paradise. It isn't the Garden of Eden. We can only vaguely imagine how beautiful must have been the garden into which God placed Adam, and the beauty that shall once again appear on earth after Christ has conquered the last enemy and sin has disappeared. But we feel," notice this, "we feel, compared with today's sordid, sin-cursed world, God has placed us in a spot of beauty which gives at least a slight foretaste of His glorious kingdom and of the beauty God has in store for those that love Him and serve Him." God has indeed given us as well a spot of beauty from which we can fulfill His will and do His work. We had a workman in here just this afternoon working on the kitchen that looks out over the lake out back. And he said, "That's the most spectacular view I've seen from any kitchen I've worked on. It's a stunning view. It's a stunning environment to live in. It's uplifting. It really does inspire you." A tiny spot of beauty, as Mr. Armstrong said there. Carrying on, this is Hebrews 10, verse 19. "Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way," it says, "which He has consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, His flesh," a new and living way. That's what God's work is here on earth to promote, to uphold. This new and living way, the way of God. the way of love. One more passage here, 1 Corinthians this time. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. It's God's way, God's lifestyle. That's what God's church is here to celebrate. That's what God's church is here to put on display. 1 Corinthians 12, 29, are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers, are all workers of miracles, it says, have all the gifts of healing, do all speak with tongues, do all interpret. Not everyone has the same position. That's what Paul's getting at here. Not everyone can be, you know, an apostle. Not everyone can be in this position or that position. But if you read earlier in this chapter, 1 Corinthians 12, God says he brings all of the members into the body and he places them where he sees fit. He places them right where they need to be. Every single member of the body fits just perfectly into God's work. So long as we stay submitted to the head, who is Jesus Christ, the head of all the operations of God's work, God's church, God's schools, whether it's the college or the academy, whatever it is, holding to the head, as it says over in Colossians 2, that's what keeps the unity in the church of God. That's what keeps that oneness, that togetherness. You look out in this world and there's so much division, so much disagreement. It's all because they get away from this new and living way. Look at the next verse, verse 31. But covet earnestly the best gifts, and yet show I unto you a more excellent way. That's what God has shown to his people. A more excellent way. It's the way of God. It's the way of give. It's the way of love. That's what you don't see on the world, on the world scene. That's what you don't see on your nightly news. Instead, you see hatred and violence and division in every respect. This excellent way is about to be set up and established in Jerusalem at the return of Christ, and it will spread over all the earth. But coming back to this verse, God's telling those in the church, it's not wrong to desire certain gifts so long as you desire those gifts, those abilities, those opportunities, those responsibilities that will help further the work of God, that will help promote this excellent way, this new and living way. It can't be for the benefit of the individual only. It has to be for the greater good. It has to be for the body of Christ. It has to be for reaching the world with a message of hope. That's why this church is here. I gave a lecture recently to our students about the example that we're to set, going through Matthew 5 there, where Jesus says we're the salt of the earth. And then right after that, where he says that we are the light of this world, and how that we ought to go and let our light shine. Let your light so shine among men, Jesus said. Setting that example, not that everyone in the church has a perfect record. We all have to battle against sin and battle our adversary. But what a way of life. What a beautiful way of living God's lifestyle. It's soon going to come onto this earth. Everywhere that you go, you're going to come upon campuses or colleges or regional offices like this one or like the one back in Edmond. Once Christ returns to this earth, once he returns to Jerusalem, and that way of love, that excellent way, begins to spread. Well, this is the first of what we hope will be many videos, many special productions that we produce from this new studio here at Edstone, and you can, of course, keep up with us by going to thetrumpet.com, our main website, where we post so many of our videos for The Trumpet Daily, for The Key of David, other special documentaries. But also, you can go to the YouTube channel, and we'll try to keep you posted along the way, too, with regular updates on social media, Facebook and Twitter, just so that you can follow and see and just get a little bit of a taste of this tiny spot of beauty, as Mr. Armstrong said there. This little foretaste of what's coming in the wonderful world tomorrow. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.